Good morning, everyone. Rob, thank you very much for the invitation to address this year's summit. The summit's become an important fixture on the payments calendar in Australia. This is the third time I've had the privilege of joining you, so thank you for inviting me back. A recurring theme across the summits has been the need to improve customer outcomes, and Rob, you just spoke about that now. And I'm really pleased to see this theme be continued to this year. This focus on customer outcomes aligns very closely with the focus of the Payment System Board. The Board wants to see a payment system that is innovative, dynamic, secure and competitive, and that serves the needs of all Australians, so our interests are very closely aligned. Interestingly, this means that the payment system needs to support Australia's digital economy. With the digital economy so important to Australia's economic prosperity in the future, we need a payment system that's fit for purpose. We'll only fully capitalise on the fantastic opportunities that are out there in the digital economy if we have a payment system that works for the digital economy. The positive news is that over recent years we have made substantial progress, and Rob, you talked about some of that progress. And in many ways, Australia's payment system is now world's first class. However, in the fast-moving world of payments, we all know things don't stand still, and there are some important areas that we still need to work on. In my remarks today, I'd like to do three things for you. First, talk about some of the progress that has been made over recent years. Second is to highlight a few of the areas where we'd like to see more progress, particularly around payments and the digital economy. And third, I'll highlight some of the questions that we'll explore in next year's review of the Payment System Regulation in Australia. So first, the progress we've made. Over recent years, there have been quite significant changes in the way that Australians make our payments. We now have greater choice than ever before. Payments are faster, and they're more flexible, and they have more data flow with the payment. The launch of the new payments platform, the MPP, in early 2008 has been an important part of this journey. This new payments infrastructure allows consumers and businesses to make real-time 24/7 payments that are data-rich and have simple addressing using the PayIDs. After the MPP was launched, it got off to a fairly slow start, but it's now hitting its stride. You can see that here. Monthly transaction values and volumes have both tripled over the past year, and in November, the platform processed an average of 1.1 million transactions a day, and that's worth around 1.1 billion a day. So it's really hitting its strides. As you can see in this next chart, the rate of take-up of fast retail payments in Australia is a little quicker than in most other countries that have introduced fast payments. I expect that we'll see a further pick-up in usage of NPP once the CBA has delivered on core NPP functionality for all of its customers. The slow implementation by CBA has been disappointing, but we expect the required functionality to be available soon, and I think we'll see the network effects take hold once that happens. All up, there are now 86 entities connected to the MPP, including 74 that are indirectly connected via direct MPP participant. There are at least six non-ADI fintechs that are using the MPP's capabilities to innovate and provide service to the customers. In addition, around 66 million individual Australian bank accounts are now able to make and receive MPP payments, so there's been real progress. Use of the PayID service has also been growing, and around 3.8 million PayIDs have been registered. As I said last year, if you haven't already got a PayID, I hope everyone in this room has. If you haven't, you should have one. And I also encourage you to ask other people for their PayIDs if you're making a payment to someone, as an alternative to asking for their BSB and account number. If we all ask for people's PayIDs, the message will get around. I think we all know that using the PayID is faster and simpler and less prone to mistakes than using a BSB and account number. One specific example of where the NPP is already bringing direct benefits to people is its use by the Australian government, supported by the banking arm of the RBA, to make emergency payments. During the current terrible bushfires, the government has been able to make use of the NPP to make immediate payments to people at a time when they're most in need, whether that's on the weekend or at night after the bank is shut for the day. One other area of the payment system where we have seen significant progress is the take-up of tap-and-go payments. Around 80% of point-of-sale transactions in Australia are now tap-and-go. That's a much higher share than in most other countries. This growth has been made possible by acquirers rolling out new technology in their terminals and by the willingness of us all to try something different. There's also been rapid take-up of mobile payments, including through wearable devices. Progress has also been made on improving the safety of electronic payments, particularly in relation to fraud and card-not-present transactions. The rate of fraud, from my perspective, is still too high, but it has come down recently, as you can see in this chart. I'd like to particularly acknowledge the work that AusPayNet has done here to develop a framework to tackle fraud. The framework strengthens the authentication requirements for certain type of transactions, including through the use of multi-factor authentication. This will help reduce card-not-present fraud and support the continued growth of online commerce in Australia. As our electronic payment system continues to improve, we're seeing a further shift away from cash and cheques. The RBA recently undertook the latest wave of our three-year survey of consumer payments use. We're still processing the results, but ahead of releasing those results next year, I thought I'd show you the latest estimate of the use of cash, which is the dot on the right-hand side there. As expected, there's been a further trend decline in the use of cash in Australia, with cash now accounting for just around a quarter of day-to-day transactions, and from what we can tell, most of these transactions are fairly small-value payments. And given the other innovations that I just spoke about, I expect that this trend will continue in future surveys. So the progress across these various fronts means that there is a positive story to be told about innovation in Australia's payment system. As I said before, in many areas, we are now world-class. At the same time, though, there are still some significant gaps and areas in the payment system that need addressing and that where progress is required to support the digital economy. And I'd like to talk about four of these areas. The first is further industry work to realise the full potential of the NPP, including its data-rich capabilities. The NPP infrastructure can help make electronic invoicing commonplace in Australia, and it can help invoices be paid on time. It can also support significant improvement in business processes as more data moves with the payment. Real-time payment and posting of funds also enables some types of delivery versus payment so that the seller can confirm receipt of funds and be confident in delivering goods and services to the buyer. So there are fantastic opportunities out there. The layered architecture of the system was designed to promote competition and innovation in the development of new overlay services. Notwithstanding this, one of the consequences of the slower-than-promised rollout of the NPP by some of the major banks is that there has been less effort than expected to develop innovative functionality. We all know payment systems are networks, and participants need to know that others will be ready to receive and use the network to get the network effects. Some banks have been reluctant to commit time and funding to support the development of new functionality, and others have been too slow to roll out their day one functionality. The slow rollout has reduced the incentive for fintechs and others to develop new ideas. So we have not yet benefited from the full network effects. The Payment System Board considered this issue as part of industry consultations on NPP access and functionality. We conducted a review jointly with the ACCC earlier this year. As part of this review, we recommended that NPPA publish a roadmap and a timeline for additional functionality, and it's agreed to develop. The first roadmap was published back in October, and NPPA also introduced a mandatory compliance framework. Under this framework, NPPA can designate core capabilities that NPP participants must support within a specified period of time with penalties for non-compliance. This is a welcome development supported by the Payment System Board. One important element of the roadmap is the development of mandated payment service to support recurring and debt-like payments. This new service will allow account holders to establish and manage standing authorisations or consents for payments to be initiated from their account by third parties. This will provide convenience, transparency and security for recurring or subscription type payments and a range of other payments as well. Another element of the roadmap has been the potential to promote the digital economy is the development of MPP messaging standards for payroll, tax, superannuation and e-invoicing payments. The standards will define the specific data elements that must be included with these payment types and will support automation and straight-through processing, and we would expect financial institutions to be competing with each other to enable their customers to make use of these data-rich elements of the MPP. Less positively, there's still uncertainty about the future of the two remaining services that we had expected to be part of the initial suite of OSCO overlay services. These are the request to pay and payment with a document service. We understand that there are still challenges in securing committed project funding and priority from NPP participants to move ahead here, even though BPAY has indicated that it's ready to complete the rollout. The RBA strongly supports the development of these additional NPP capabilities, which are likely to deliver significant value for businesses and for the broader community, for the customers that we all talk about. A second area where the Payment System Board would like to see further progress is the provision of portable digital identity services that allow Australians to securely prove who they are in the digital environment. Today, our digital identity system in Australia is fragmented and siloed, and that's resulted in a proliferation of industry credentials and passwords. This gives rise to security vulnerabilities and creates significant inconvenience for people and inefficiencies in the system, which can undermine the development of Australia's digital economy. They also generate compliance risks and other costs for financial institutions, so it's strongly in our interest to make progress here. I think it's fair to say that a number of other countries are well ahead of us in this area. I think it's a priority to address. The Australian Payments Council has recognised the importance of this and has developed the Trust ID framework. The government's Digital Transformation Agency has also been working on a complementary framework which specifies how digital identity services will be used to access government services online. The challenge now is to build on these frameworks and develop a strong digital identity ecosystem in Australia with competing but interoperable digital identity services. I think it's in our interest that we do this. It's in the interest of the customers we want to serve. The rollout of open banking and the consumer data right will bring additional competition between financial service providers, and a strong system of digital identity is likely to reduce the scope for identity fraud while providing convenient authentication as part of an open banking regime. A strong digital identity system in Australia would also open up new areas of digital commerce and help reduce online payments fraud. It will also help build trust in a wide range of online transactions. Building this trust is increasingly important as people spend more of their time and more of their money online. So the Payment System Board would like to see some concrete solutions developed here and developed and adopted in Australia. It's an important priority. A third area I'd like to see more progress is on reducing the cost of cross-border payments. For many people, the costs here are still too high and the payments are still too hard to make. This is another area it's important for us to address. It's an issue not just for Australians but also for our neighbours as well. I recently chaired a meeting of the governors of the South Pacific Central Banks, and there I heard firsthand about the problems caused by the high cost of cross-border payments. Analysis by the World Bank indicates that the price of sending money from Australia has been consistently higher than the average price paid across the G20 economies. And a recent ACCC inquiry found that the prices for cross-border retail payment services are opaque in Australia. Customers are not always aware of the retail exchange rate that's being paid, and the wholesale, or they're not aware of the final amount of foreign currency that they're going to receive. And there are also sometimes add-on fees. As part of the RBA's monitoring of the marketplace, our staff recently conducted a form of online shadow shopping exercise, exploring the pricing of international money transfer facilities by both banks and some of the non-bank digital money transfer operators. The main results are summarised in this chart here. As you can see, there is a very wide range of prices across providers, and it really highlights the importance of shopping around and getting the best deal. In nearly every case, the major banks are more expensive than the digital money transfer operators. For the major banks, the average markup over the wholesale exchange rate is around 5.5%. That's versus around 1% for the money transfer operators. The graph also illustrates why the cost of cross-border payments is such an issue for the South Pacific countries. The costs are noticeably higher in this area than for payments to most other countries. This is a particular problem as many people in the South Pacific rely on receiving remittances from family and friends in Australia and New Zealand. In many cases, low-income people are paying very high fees, and it's important we address this issue. As is evident from the graph, most digital money transfer operators do not provide services to the small South Pacific economies, which limits customers' choice of provider in those countries. In part, the high costs and the slow speed of international money transfers is the result of inefficiencies in the global correspondent banking process. Given these inefficiencies, it's understandable why some large fintech firms operating across borders see an opportunity here. Where people are being served poorly by existing arrangements as they are here, new solutions are likely to emerge with new technologies. So this represents a challenge to the traditional financial institutions to offer better services at lower cost to their customers while still meeting their AML and CTF requirements. Central banks also have a role to play here. And the meetings that I go to in Basel, there's an increased focus on what the central banking community can do to reduce the cost of cross-border payments. One example of this is the introduction of standardised and richer payment messaging globally through the adoption of the new ISO standard. The RBA is also working closely with the Reserve Bank of New Zealand and AUSTRAC, as well as the South Pacific Central Banks, to develop a regional framework to address know-your-customer concerns that have limited competition and kept prices high in the region. The fourth area where we'd like to see more progress is improving the operational resilience of Australia's electronic payment system. Disruptions to retail payments hurts both consumers and businesses. Given that many people now carry little or no cash in their wallet or purse, the reliability of electronic payment services has become critical to the smooth functioning of the Australian economy. We understand that given the complexity of IT systems, some level of payment incidents and outages are likely to be inevitable. But it is apparent from the data that we have that the frequency and the duration of retail payment outages have risen sharply over recent times. Given this, the RBA has been working with APRA and the industry to enhance data on retail payment outages to increase transparency around what's going on in this area. We hope this greater transparency around the reliability of these services will allow institutions to better benchmark their operational performance. So these are the four broad issues where we'd like to see further progress. The final thing that I'd like to do is to talk about the Payment System Board's review of retail payments regulation next year. The review is intended to be wide-ranging and to cover all aspects of the retail payments landscape and not just the RBA's existing card regulation. As the first step in the process, we released an issues paper a couple of weeks ago, and I hope you've had a chance to have a look at it. We've asked for submissions by the 31st of January. There'll also be opportunities for many of you to meet with the RBA staff conducting the review. The review will cover a lot of ground, including hopefully some of the issues that I just mentioned. There are, though, a few other questions that I'd like to highlight. The first of these is, what can be done to further reduce the cost of electronic payments in Australia? Both the Productivity Commission and the Black Economy Task Force have called on us to examine this issue. I think it's understandable why. As we move to a predominantly electronic world, the cost of electronic payments becomes a bigger issue for us all. The Payment System Board regulation of interchange fees and the surcharging framework, as well as our efforts to promote competition and encourage least cost routing, have all helped lower payments costs in Australia. They've all worked. At issue is, how do we make further progress here? What balance of regulation and market forces are going to best deliver lower costs for Australian consumers and businesses? Relevant questions here that we'll be examining are whether interchange fees should be lowered further, how best to ensure that merchants can choose the payment rails that give them the best value for money, and whether restrictions relating to the no surcharge rules should be applied to the buy now, pay later schemes. A second broad issue is, what's the future of the cheque system? Cheque use in Australia has been declining sharply. As you can see, the number of cheques written fell by another 19% over the past year, and the value of cheques is down 30% over the past year, largely reflecting the transfer of real estate. The real estate industry has made to electronic property settlement. I think, as you can see from this graph, at some point it will be appropriate to wind up the cheque system in Australia. And that point is getting closer. Before this happens, though, it's important that alternative payment methods are available for those who rely on cheques. Using the MPP infrastructure to develop new payment solutions is likely to help here, so I encourage you to think about how that can best be done. A third question is whether there is a case for some rationalisation of Australia's three domestically focused payment schemes. That's BPAY, FPOS and NPPA. A number of industry participants have indicated to us that they face significant and sometimes conflicting investment demands from the three different schemes. This raises the question of whether some consolidation or some form of coordination of investment priorities might be in the public interest. Fourth and finally, what are the implications for the regulatory framework of technology changes, new entrants and new business models? As we all know, the world of payments is moving quickly, with new technologies and new players offering solutions to long-standing problems. At the same time, though, expectations regarding security, resilience, functionality and privacy are continually rising, as you all know. Meeting these expectations can be challenging, but doing so is critical to building and maintaining the trust that lies at the heart of an effective modern payment system. The entry of non-financial firms into the payments market also raises new regulatory issues. As part of the review, it would be good to hear how the regulatory system can best encourage a dynamic and innovative payment system in Australia that fully supports the needs of its customers. So these are some of the many issues on our agenda, and we're looking forward to receiving your input over coming months. But for now, thank you very much for listening, and I'd be happy to answer a few questions. Thank you.
So we have time for a couple of questions for the Governor to officially wrap up his responsibilities, public responsibilities this year. So please just raise your hand, name and affiliation. Here we go, we've got one up here.
Dr. Lowe, it's James Ayres from the Australian Financial Review, I'm sorry, and I've got two questions if I may. The first one on the potential consolidation there of BPAY, FPOS and the NPP. I'm just wondering how any decision in that regard would be governed, given the close relationships between NPPA and the RBA. Does the RBA focus on the customer outcomes there or the benefits of particular schemes? And my second question, Governor, if you might indulge me, is slightly broader. than payments, but does the Reserve Bank agree with Kenneth Hayne's opinion expressed yesterday that directors who fail to act on climate risk are neglecting their legal duties?
Your second question is way outside my lane, so I'm going to avoid that if you don't mind. On the first one, I think if there is a case for consolidation, and I don't think that case has yet been established, it may emerge. I don't see it being driven by the Payment System Board. It would be driven by the industry participants. How that best takes place, I don't really have a particularly strong view. I raise the issue, though, because many of the institutions in this room say that there are competing and conflicting investment priorities, and sometimes that gets in the way of progress. So the high-level question is whether some consolidation would be in the public interest, and we've got an open mind about that, and we're not going to drive it, but if the industry would like to explore it, we'll be supportive of it.
Any more questions? We have one over here.
Governor, if you indulge me as well, Michael Heath from Bloomberg News. It's just our last chance to get hold of you. On the GDP on Thursday, I'm just wondering what you made of that, whether that's a real look in the rearview mirror and what you're seeing perhaps from liaison is looking a bit better in terms of consumption and retail and that sort of thing, or whether we're sort of still in the doldrums and 3Q GDP represents where we were at.
Well, I can't avoid this question by saying it's outside my lanes. The GDP outcome was broadly in line with our expectations. Growth of 1.7% during the year was what we had expected. I think if the surprise was the weakness in consumption growth. In the September quarter, households did get a boost in their disposable income. They got it from lower interest rates and the tax payments the government's been making. So the surprise was the consumers decided to save a fair share of that that extra income. The evidence, though, over time is that if Australians have extra income, they spend a fair chunk of it. So I'm still confident that over time, people will spend this extra income. This is why there are long and variable lags associated with monetary policy. We get the money today and it takes us time to adjust our spending plans. When interest rates come down, it takes people time to adjust their mortgage payments, but eventually they do that. And the evidence from all previous tax payments is that people do eventually spend a fair chunk of it. It's quite possible in the current environment that the spending's taking a bit longer. Many of us have got a high level of debt, probably too much debt, and we're using the opportunity, the extra income, to pay down the debt. But eventually, when we do that, I think we'll spend more of it. So the weak consumption growth was a bit of a surprise, but I don't think it has particular messages about the future.
Great. We have a question just at the side here.
Dr. Lowe, Sophie Ellsworth from the Daily Telegraph. You talked today about the decline of cash, but we have seen in many cases customers still being charged significant surcharges and constant bank outages. Is there still always a place for cash in Australia because of situations like these?
Yeah, that's a good question. I feel like in the future, perhaps cash is going to be the payment instrument you use when kind of a disaster happens or there's a failure of the electronic system. And I think most of us who use tap-and-go payments all the time still carry some cash in our wallets or purses because you can't be 100% sure that you're going to be able to use the electronic system. So if you look forward into the future, I think people are still going to want to hold some of the banknotes the Reserve Bank produces in their wallet or purse, just in case. It would be good if they didn't need to. If the whole system was kind of electronic, I think that would, in the end, that's going to be a more effective solution for Australians. But while ever there are outages and there are high costs of electronic payments, people will always want to use cash. So I can see the end of the cheque system. I can't see the end of the cash system, though.
Okay, I think last two questions. We'll start here, if we can.
So the microphone's coming.
Yep. Jackie Kalman from ANZ. Just wondering, you mentioned the mandated payment service, obviously the migration to ISO. Do you see that the direct entry system will need to be also an end date set for that? And if so, do Do you have an indicative time frame in mind for this?
Well, the direct entry system has really been the workhorse of Australia's payment system, but it's outdated, isn't it? And now I'm fond of telling this story, so if you can indulge me telling me, I'll tell it one more time. You know, when you send a message you make a payment using the direct entry system, you've got 14 or 18 characters to kind of say your name in the invoice, and if you're like me, occasionally you run out of characters. The reason that it has only 14 or 18 characters is the original message length was 80 characters. And it was 80 characters because that's many their holes were in the punch cards. So the workhorse of Australia's payment system is still constrained by the punch cards. So it needs to be updated. We need to be able to send more than 14 or 18 characters with our payments. I think eventually that system will need to shut down. The Reserve Bank isn't going to drive it. But I think the industry will have to think about that as part of its medium-term strategy, what happens to the direct entry system. We've got a much better system out there. It's faster, it's quicker, it's more convenient, more secure, more modern message standards. But it's not something that we're going to drive, but I hope the industry does drive it.
Okay, one last quick question, which I promised the gentleman down here before.
Governor Julian Blokhovsky from ITNews, just on outages and the data that's been collected there finally in a consistent manner, is that going to be made public at an institutional level so that people can see the performance of institutions in terms of outages in the future? And just on the consolidation of the domestic schemes, it's a huge question, but I mean, who would be the umpire in such a scenario if there was to be a consolidation? It's great to throw it out to industry, but you know, there has to be some sort of regulation.
On the second one, I think the ACCC would have interest in the topic, and so would the Payment System Board, but we don't see ourselves as being the umpire here. If there were to be consolidation, I think we'd need to be able to demonstrate, the industry would need to demonstrate that it was in the public interest, and it's quite possible that public interest case will emerge. On the transparency of outages and the publication of the data, we're very keen to see that published at the individual institution level. We've done some consultation earlier in the year, and I think it's fair to say that not all institutions were enamoured by the idea of publishing it at the institution level, but we think it's important. It's important for the public transparency and confidence in the system, and hopefully it allows institutions to benchmark themselves against other institutions. The process we're going through now is to work out what form of transparency, what form that should take, how do we provide data that's most meaningful to people. And we're still working through that with the industry, but over the course of the next 6 months we'd hope to finalise that. Because as I said in response to one of the other questions, that it's really important that people have confidence in the electronic payment system. We've seen examples through the course of this year where businesses have not been able to sell their goods and services because the electronic payment system went down and people didn't have enough cash in their wallets. So it's really important to our modern economy that the electronic payment system's working well. Both APRA and the Reserve Bank have very strong interest in this. If standards didn't improve, both APRA and the Reserve Bank have the power to set standards in this area. I would hope that we wouldn't have to do that, but it's a possibility if things don't improve.
Great. Look, I think we have to wrap it there. We're a little bit behind time, so I would like everyone to join me in thanking the Governor of the Reserve Bank, Philip Lowe, for speaking today.